Hello, listeners. This podcast is hosted by International Idea. In the next minutes, we will help you make sense of what's happening today in democracy worldwide.
Hello, and welcome to International Ideas podcast, Democracy Ideas. My name is Laura Thornton, Director of Global Programs. Today, I have with me Birgitta Olsen, who is Director for Political Party Programming at the National Democratic Institute. Ms. Olsen served for almost two decades in Swedish politics as a youth leader, member of parliament, party spokesperson, as well as minister for European affairs and democracy issues. She's also a well-known writer, speaker, and activist on feminist issues. Birgitta, welcome.
Thank you so much, Laura, for inviting me. It's a great pleasure to be with you here.
Great. Well, you know, we are doing this pod in honor of Women's Day, which is coming up. And so I'd really like to use this opportunity to discuss women in politics, an issue I know that's very close to your heart. And to sort of start off, I'd like to ask you a little bit about the demand side of this. You know, based on both your personal experiences, but also your extensive global experience, what are some mechanisms that you've encountered to build more inclusive political parties? What have you undertaken, for example, when you were with your former party, for example, to build more diverse candidate base? And what are things that have worked or not worked? And how do party leaders, who are mostly male, respond to incentives? What kind of incentives can work in this regard? So those were a lot of questions, but yeah. I'd love your reflections on that.
No, thank you so much, Laura. And I think first, it's very important to understand that we have no kind of quick fix solution on this topic. And we have no kind of superpower like Wonder Woman on how to deal with gender equality and traditional old-fashioned gender roles that we've seen for thousands of years. So that's something I think we need to start off by acknowledging when we work to have more women into politics and political parties. But I think it's important also in Sweden, we say, dig where you are. You need to start where you are right now when it comes to empower women. And different countries and different regions in the world have different kind of, experiences. But the experience of being a woman is also kind of the same, because we're fighting the same kind of toxic male culture in politics that exists in every country, even though it's different how it's framed and so on. So I think it's important to maybe first start off by looking at society. Can women at all become candidates and be active into political parties? And even in more modern Western countries in the world, we still see a lot of challenges. It's hard if women still have the main responsibility for childcare and raising the children. How can you have as much power in outside the family if you still have that kind of major shore? So I think it's important here also to look upon the structure in society. Sometimes when people are asking me, what would be if you would describe from a Swedish context, the best tools for having almost 50% women in the Swedish parliament, I would say that the subsidized parental leave for both men and women is a major, very important tool for that one. Another one would be getting rid of the joint taxation in the 1970s, so more women came out on the labor market and kind of got the appetite for politics. And also, I would say, affordable, subsidized public childcare is also very important. So I think that's interesting to put it in a bigger context. But what do we see from a global perspective? What is stopping women to get active into politics? One very important component is the parties themselves. We find a lot of restrictions. Another big thing in many countries is campaign financing. Men have the networks, they have the tools and connections. And the first thing would actually be, and that's very sad, that's violence. And I'm talking about violence. It could be hate speech. It could be harassments. It could be sexual harassment. It could be physical violence. So that's kind of three major reasons that also are kind of restricting women to get into politics. And Attend the Eye through the years. I mean, we have a fantastic gender, women, and democracy team led by Sandra Pepperam, who's our director for that team. And they do a lot of work. And they always talk about the three C's to get women into politics and what we need to work on, three angles. And that's capacity. It's highly important to see the capacity of a woman and the capacity of a society and political party, how to kind of go into that one. The second thing is confidence. I still think that's extremely important. When I was in politics, I used to quote the rock star Janis Joplin, because she always said, do not compromise yourself because you are all you've got. And that's extremely, I think, important to see confidence in a person and how to build that, because that's why how you can turn into a marathon runner and not a sprinter. And you can continue as I did for 2 decades in party politics. And the third thing would be connections. Connections, connections, connections. That's what women lack in most societies. And that's also the access to get money to your campaigns or to be in the right kind of environments to have that influence. So that would be three things that I wanted to kind of raise in this angle.
No, those are, you know, you unpacked a lot there. Certainly, I remember once being struck by someone from Emily's List, who we were using as a trainer. And I remember her saying, you can't just ask a woman once to run for office. You have to ask them like 15 times. Mm-hmm. So, and oftentimes the excuse you hear on the demand side from the parties is, well, we tried, but no one wants to join us, without a lot of self-evaluation about, gee, why might that be? Why might mm-hmm. women not want to join us? And this sort of, my experience in the countries I worked in, that the appealing to a sense of equity mm-hmm. is not nearly as effective as talking about political advantage. And so again, I sort of circle back to the incentive system and who, you know, who can be the best messenger to the parties are the gatekeepers, right?
Mm-hmm,
so
they are.
Who can be the best messengers in terms of making the case for why it's not the right thing to do, although it is, but the advantageous thing to do that mm-hmm. will result in more votes and therefore more power.
No, I think the incentives can be so different. I mean, it depends on who you ask. But I think what Emily's List and other fantastic networks around the world, we have them in almost all countries. What they are doing, that they are providing and showing great role models, women, real life women that people can relate to. And that could also sometimes be a burden for women, that you need to be this shining role model all the time. But sometimes that's the thing you need to do. I mean, when I was appointed myself as a minister, or actually, yes, before I was appointed, that was 11 years ago, I could read on one of the most serious Swedish newspaper, Dagens Nyheter, I could read on the first page that it's rumors that Birgitta Ohlsson will be appointed as the new Minister of European Affairs, but that will not be the case because we've heard that she's pregnant. So that caused a big debate in one of the most kind of gender equal countries in the world, Sweden, that the newspaper could kind of write this article, and I had to fight for myself. I didn't want to be known as the pregnant incoming minister, but I had to fight for myself when I said, well, that will not be a problem because I'm married to a modern man, not to dinosaurs. I was trying to, you know, make my case as a pregnant, and I stayed as a minister for 5 years. And I gave birth to my both daughters during these years, and I brought them to the prime minister's office. They almost grew up, learned to walk in these rooms. And I had to show a lot of myself to kind of show people that you can be a young mother and you can also be a minister. It's not that kind. Yeah, you can do that. And it's, of course, people had done that before, but everyone had been very criticized. But that was a very good kind of, I think, awesome example that people really stood up for me from different political parties. Some people actually said, some conservative parliamentarians, that my wife would never accept that. She would stay home. She would not accept the offer. But also a lot of people actually supported me from the civil society, from ordinary people that are not involved into politics. strong people from different parts of society really stood up for me. So I think that's also important, as Emily's List and other people are doing, to show incentives that that you can combine all these roles. And I think that's extremely important to do that. And also, you focused also before, Laura, in your question about kind of the incentives for men, for male party leaders. And that's also one area that we work a lot on when it comes to at NDI, to evaluate, elaborate, and kind of reveal this kind of male toxic political culture that men need to do more to change this. And I read this kind of interesting quote from David Solomon, who is the CEO and the chairman of Goldman Sachs. And he said a year ago that I'm focused on advancing gender equality because it's right. Mm-hmm. It's necessary. Mm-hmm. It's a business imperative. And it's my responsibility. And of course, I mean, it should be, yes, it's right. It's necessary. That should be the only thing that we should mention. But what I learned through the years is very often when you want to make the case for more women into politics, all different ages, it's important sometimes to show the story of what's in it for me, also for the male establishment in political parties. And then you need to be smart and feministic and strategic when you maneuver in this world. And of course, I mean, every political party, they need voters. And women are fortunately voters in most countries of the world today. So that's one very big reason to show that one. But also, I think to make the case that sometimes you need to have other arguments than the classical human rights oriented arguments, yes, yes, like Hillary Clinton did at the Beijing conference many, many years ago. So I think that's important. I mean, women's rights are human rights, but sometimes you need to be strategic on how you maneuver in this system. And also, I think it's important here, because what was my main, I would say, benefit for all years in politics that could give me a lot of space pushing for different, sometimes very radical political proposal, that was that I had so many voters behind me. And that comes to the confidence part, because I could have this maneuver situation in my political party and in parliament, because I could always say that, well, hey, 15% of the people that voted for the party in our constituency, they voted for me. So I could always make a case for myself and I wasn't questioned that much because of that. So I think that's also important, also how to strengthen strong individual female politicians, because they will also be the ones that are the role models for young girls in society, like Hillary Clinton and others have been through the years, that people could, Kamala Harris right now from the US context, and we have them in every country in the world. So that's also important, I think, to allow women to shine, to allow women to be radical, to allow women to say yes to power and so on, because that's encouraged a lot of other women to walk the same kind of path, paving the way for others. So that's also something I think we need to acknowledge. And connecting again how to kind of convince other people that might not understand why gender equality is all about human rights. You also sometimes need to have economic incentives. And I will never forget, I once been to this World Economic Forum in Davos, and that was in January in 2014. And I was then pregnant with my second daughter, and I had this great opportunity at one of the lunches to sit together with Christine Lagarde, who was leading the IMF, and Sheryl Sandberg from Facebook. Yeah. And I was, I mean, that was, yeah, I was, you know, really kind of inspired and it was fantastic to just listen to them. But it was so interesting when they went, and you had the UN Secretary General attended the meeting. You had all the different ministers of finance and some prime ministers from the most relevant countries attending this lunch of 50 folks. And it was so interesting because when both Sheryl Sandberg and Christine Lagarde did their interventions to this audience during the lunch, they were focusing a lot on economical growth connected to gender equality, why we need to have more women out on the labor market to get more growth in a society. And I think they needed to use that argument to get these all different men to listen. And I had a quote when I was the Minister of European Affairs, and that was, Europe cannot afford to have the best educated housewives in the world. And that kind of, that went through this kind of media media discussions when you link it. So sometimes you need to kind of be smart and strategic when you maneuver and you try to pave the way for others.
I think, yeah, you've raised a lot of good points. I think it's, you're absolutely right. And this is something that I encountered as well is, yes, okay, you can appeal to, as I said, the human rights angle. But the tactical angle is very important. And it's very real for if you're a male MP and you've got a party list system and you introduce some sort of party quota internally or externally, legislation, that's literally taking a spot from you. So it's in a very sort of zero-sum game. And I really like your point about bringing your own constituency with you. So it's not even just necessarily about breaking into the party, but demonstrating to the party that you've got all these people behind you is sort of an effective tactic. And I also like your point about the evidence of economic growth backing an argument. And we certainly have seen the data on the greater the number of women in elected positions, the higher economic growth rate, the more income equality, et cetera. But I also want to go back to your imagery and the visibility of women in these positions. And I think that's so interesting what you said. And I remember when Sarah Palin was the vice presidential candidate in the US, that people gave her a hard time because she had a 3-month-old at home. And of course, no one's ever even knows the age of men politicians' children. And now we have, you know, now we're seeing images of women breastfeeding in parliament. We see pregnant women and that I wonder if that impact of that visual will have a great inspiring factor for young women ahead.
I think for sure. I think that's absolutely, and I think all the discussions also around, I mean, that's kind of this eternal topic through the last 30 years in global politics about quotas or not using quotas. And I think it's important to quotas, they do exist and they need to exist in many countries because otherwise we would never have change. And sometimes you need to have this kind of sunset clause that, for them to disappear. But also when you have the quotas, you can see in many countries that you have like this A-list and B-list of female parliamentarians, the one that have made it through the general system and fighting for their spot, and the other ones that have been through the kind of the quota system. And that's also the reality that we need to discuss. So that's why I think it's important not only to focus on the structures. They are important, and you need to tear them down. You need to the glass ceiling. You need to work on that. But you also need to have the strong cases of individual women that are in a very patriarchal system still kind of fighting their way and reaching their position, because that creates the real kind of shattering into this glass ceiling to see them do that, even though they have to fight much harder and so on. And that also in quotas, I mean, Adian, you've been working with quotas for many years. We've been doing that same at NDI. And we can see, I mean, different system in different parts of the world. I mean, in the Swedish context, since the 1990s, we've had the voluntary quotas. It's up to the political parties to create that system. Most of them have the zipper system. You have one woman, one man, one woman, one man on the list. But you can also see that some political parties, they do not maybe need to use that model any longer, because when the members are voting for the different candidates, it's getting kind of fair and just, and you can get a good kind of diverse representations because the members want to have that. But it's still important to be the feminist, I think, also watchdog into political parties, because in far many countries, people seem to be kind of a bit too relaxed sometimes, and they think that gender equality, when you reach a certain level, it will stay that forever. But it's like democracy. You need to fight for democracy and gender equality every single day of your life. And also now when we have this very tough situation with I guess it's like your 14th consecutive year when it comes to decline for democracy on a global level. I mean, that is also a big attack on women's rights, on women as parliamentarians, on the right to free choice, on the right to earn your own salary and be out on the labor market. It's attacks on the independent woman in every single country of the world. So I think that's to see the global big kind of context is highly important nowadays.
You know, it's an interesting, one other interesting point you raise is about, in terms of quotas and internal party structures. Often the arguments I heard against quotas was, women can. They can join our party and they can compete. And it presumes a level of internal party democracy that usually isn't there. So, I mean, the link between sort of women and greater inclusion in general and diversity in general is sort of based, isn't it, on internal competitive equal opportunity candidate selection process, right? What role do you think the sort of internal decision making of the party has here?
Extremely important, and I think that most political parties in the world actually would need to kind of strengthen their code of conduct and ethics and so on. That's not a phenomena for new political parties in emerging democracies, or so that's something that's a global approach that we need to have the political party integrity to work on that. But also, I think if you have more opportunities inside a political party, and that could be via different networks, it could be via the women's wing if they have that, and other such structures. I think that will also create a lot of different kind of stairs on how to climb to the power. It's not only one kind of structure. And one thing that I think have been very interesting from my background, it is a strange phenomenon that in the Scandinavian countries, and I would say in the Western European countries, we have quite many more young people selected to parliament, and that also includes young women. And I think here, the political youth organizations, the youth wings, they've been very strong in this, especially in the Scandinavian countries, for decades. I mean, I would say from the 1950s or even before. So I think they've also been fantastic tools. I mean, they've been male dominated, and some of them still are, but they've been a fantastic tool. I think sometimes even more important than the women's wing to create so many strong female politicians, because if you start in a political youth wing movement when you're around like 15 or so, and you learn democracy from scratch here, and you go to the meetings and you learn how to debate, and you maybe have mentors like I had, and I've been a mentor to, I'm not sure how many people through the years, but that people encourage you and teach you, you should not only do the bureaucratic things or write a protocol, you should be on stage right now. And that's what counts in the long run if you want to be the future minister or so on. So kind of, I think they have been very interesting. I think they should get more feministic cred than maybe some other phenomena. And I would see if you look upon the Swedish prime ministers today and also the Scandinavian prime ministers or you know, ministers of foreign affairs or finance, it's hard to identify folks with no background from the political youth wings and organizations. Well, you have them too, of course, and you should have other channels into politics, but they are a very good school, I think, for especially young women to get into politics.
It's you brought up the issue of harassment, and that was one of, you know, I when I previously worked at NDI and I was working in the country Georgia, we had a big problem with videos being released of women politicians and other well-known women journalists and women in sort of high profile positions of their personal lives being released to the public. And we did focus groups and with women who said this was a big turnoff for them in entering political life, rightly so. Mm-hmm. I know that NDI has a interesting Not the Cost campaign, which targets violence and discrimination and hate speech against women. I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about this campaign. Mm-hmm.
No, I think it's a very strong campaign, and I think it's both very deep and it's both very wide. We've done things together with Mona Lena Crook, who is a very, acknowledged professor working on these things. And I think it has showed a lot that kind of sometimes culture beats strategy inside political parties. And that's why it's so important to acknowledge the kind of the walk the talk on feminist issues, and also to identify how you can, with kind of strategic tools, you can also change this toxic political culture. And through the Not the Cause campaign, which has been very, I think, interesting for me to follow. I've not been a year with the NDI, but what I've seen so far is so many different witnesses, women from different parts of the world, sharing their stories. And that's something I think we need to do more. Because when I was in politics myself, I mean, and that was a really kind of turn off factor sometimes to continue in politics. And that was the biggest relief when I ended my political career, was to never getting these kind of hate speech comments in your email every single day. And sometimes getting used to random men calling your nasty names and belittling yourself in front of your daughters when you go grocery shopping, or getting these people shouting after you when you're out with your family and so on, that people would never do to a male politician when it comes to this kind of sexist touch on it. So I think that has been very important through the Not the Cause campaign, that that we kind of show that this is not only a story that's happening for women into politics in new democracies or in the closing space countries. It's a very kind of a global phenomena that women are harassed from this point of view. So that, I think, has been the major story. And when it comes to kind of showing the stories, it's very common that female politicians, they get the advice from security folks and others to kind of just be quiet. I got that advice for many years. And then I thought sometimes that, well, I'm the only one that this is happening to right now. But when I started to talk with my colleagues, I could very easily figure out that the same man that was actually harassing me, he was harassing 10 other female politicians in the parliament that kind of disturbed him in one way or the other. So I think that's also very important to create political spaces for women to talk, not self-silence yourself, and kind of how to avoid to get thick-skinned and to maneuver better in this toxic climate. You need to have the security measures. You need to have your political party standing up for you. But sometimes the harassment might come from the political party itself. I mean, that's very common in many countries. So I think that's some of the reasons why I think that the Not the Cause campaign have been important to show sisterhood, to share your stories, and to learn tools on smart safety. How you kind of collect evidence for yourself when it's happening to you, take screenshots, report to the police and to your political party. If you can do that, sometimes it might be the party or the police that is harassing you in some cases, but also to kind of skip the self-censorship. That's important.
It's interesting. And I think, your point about maybe being a little bit more united and public about it, as opposed to sort of keeping it under wraps and exposing it, might have sort of a backlash for those people who are behaving in such a way. In the case of Georgia, where this was happening, some of the women just stood up and was like, yeah, that's a video of me. And in a way, it was sort of interesting how, now, of course, it's a very traditional society and it didn't work everywhere, but a lot of people sort of got mobilized by that and were like, yeah, it's me too, you know, and then it sort of lost, the air kind of came out of the balloon, you know, and so it might not have been in the future as much of an effective tool to go after women in this way.
And also another thing that is so interesting, and I know that was very different in different countries, but when the kind of Me Too campaign and all the discussions around that in many countries, like in Sweden, it covered almost like all parts of the society, women in the army, women in the police, young women at schools, female parliamentarians, women in the healthcare sector, you know, every kind of angle in the society had its own kind of Me Too statements and discussions and so on. But in some countries that are considered a bit kind of developed when it comes to gender equality, they had no debate at all, or the debate came a few years later. And I think also in the neighboring country of Denmark here, that was very interesting that the Me Too debate came like last year in politics, because even though Denmark is a very gender equal country compared to many others, it took them some years to really kind of start the discussions about these different things. And then some of the change did happen. And I know, for example, in other cases like Zimbabwe, that it's a very closed society. Some individual female parliamentarians, they kind of raised the issue of the Me Too and were so brave of doing that. So I think that's where you need to show the sisterhood to and not only women should support the sisterhood, but also male politicians. You need to be this guerrilla fighter, and you need to identify the agents of change among the men too.
Absolutely. Another question, and I know that I've taken a lot of your time, but another thing that I remember, actually, Sandra, who you mentioned earlier, director of the gender programs in NDI, and she and I had this conversation at one point, that, you know, it isn't just gender programming and women in politics isn't about just adding more women and mixing. Add women and mix is not going to solve the problem. So what is sort of a more comprehensive and holistic approach to addressing gender issues, particularly from Parliament, beyond just the quantitative? What can we do in parliaments as legislators, and you have direct experience here, in advancing a feminist agenda beyond just increasing numbers of women representatives?
Well, as I mentioned before, I think it's important to identify the agents of change, cross-party and cross-gender. Most radical friends that I had when I was in parliament on everything from LGBTI issues or feminist issues, they were sometimes not even in my party, and they were not women. They could come from another party. It could be a man from another political party that I could do a lot of collaboration together to work on these issues. So I think you need to break down these barriers, because you need also to kind of ally yourself with people outside in the society, with civil society organizations, strong voices, and nowadays in social media, maybe with strong influencers. Quite many of the young girls that are now dominating our social media, Instagram and Twitter and so on, they are also very strong feminists, and they are pushing for the pro-choice agenda. They are pushing, they are revealing stories about sexual harassment. They are, you know, very brave. And I think that's also important to build broader alliances. And I think it's important also for the feminist movement inside the political parties and in the parliament that they should not only stay in the kind of academical discussion and debate. You need to reach out more broadly. I was very happy when I was in politics when the magazines for teenage girls, when they reached out to me to talk about domestic violence or what kind of advices I could give young girls. And I thought that's like fantastic, because I can reach a broader audience. They're not even allowed to vote for me in the elections because they're not turned 18 years old. But that's something to see, to kind of the broad alliances. I think that's important to do. And if I look from the Swedish context, when we kind of had a better and stronger, more feminist policy on domestic violence, that all actually came from this initiative that was a cross-party initiative from different women in different political parties in the 90s that joined up together to kind of see where they could identify flaws in the legislation. And also on issues on rape, for example, when we've had a stricter and better legislation on that. That was caused via young women in the civil society that arranged the big manifestations, and they invited us parliamentarians from different parties. And it was so kind of powerful to be there, you know, when thousands or thousands of people are showing up to just show their support that we need to do something about this. And so think outside the parliament. That would be my advice sometimes, to strengthen the feminist issues inside the parliament. Go out of this box.
So true. And also the role that outside groups can play in terms of oversight on these issues is important. I was wondering if you had thoughts about the effectiveness of initiatives such as, you know, gender impact assessments of legislation or gender oversight of executive provisions. Do you think this has been a useful tool for legislators to use, as well as those outside, in terms of monitoring policy and legislation to ensure that it impacts, there's a comprehension of how this could impact people of different genders differently?
Well, as I said earlier, I think it's hard to identify like one specific tool that is the quick fix solution, but I think they are absolutely important, and to have statistics and data, I mean, that's the best friend that a feminist could have. Mm-hmm. And that when you have the numbers on your side and you can show, you know, real examples to that, I think that's very important to do that. And sometimes you need to have other people's kind of go outside the box and look inside your political party and the structures and so on to see some things that you maybe, not by being evil or so, but you maybe not registered them yourself through the years because you've been around for many years. So I think that's also to have this kind of the fresh feminist eyes on something. That's extremely important. And that's what you do at IDEA, and that's what we do at NDI when we do the gender assessments, studying different countries, interviewing numbers of female and male politicians about structures and problems and different fields and so on. So that's important to see. But it's also important to never forget that the culture beats the strategy. I mean, you can have as many assessments as you have. You can have all the tools. You can have the gender-sensitive budgeting. You can have the gender-responsive budgeting. You can have all these different tools in place. But if the culture is still kind of toxic and not allowing women to be individuals as politicians and to strive for their own political goals, I mean, then not much will happen.
100%. No magic bullets here in this field.
No.
But we appreciate so much the work that you've been doing, and also your role as a role model for so many women in Sweden and elsewhere, and a role model for children. You're a children's book author as well, and I think that hits on something very important. If we're going to change the culture, it's about educating not just our daughters, but our sons to be feminists. And and that's the long game. So
And just was to end on a kind of positive note, I think what I see right now, I see so many kind of moments of flux in the world where we see women strong leaders or leading the freedom movements in countries like Belarus and a few years ago in Sudan, so we see so many good examples. I mean, the brave female politicians, parliamentarians in Poland that are fighting for LGBTI rights and for pro-choice and so on. So we see so different, so many women that are really paving the way for others and for themselves. And let's be inspired by them.
Absolutely. And again, it goes back to the sort of the visual. If children look up and see that possibility. I remember when I was little and Geraldine Ferraro was a vice presidential candidate. And it was, you know, I remember getting in fights in the playground because how could she possibly be there? But
now we have Kamala Harris.
My daughter's looking up at the vice president going, well, duh, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Of course, why not?
Yeah, and that's also, I think, also one thing that that it is interesting that even in a country, for example, like Sweden, I mean, we have almost 50% women in parliament, but we've never had a woman as a prime minister so far. And I guess, unfortunately, it will take a few years in Sweden until we will reach that feminist goal. And in the United States, you've never had a woman as a as a president. I think that's also to kind of break down this image of that that women cannot openly say that, I want to have power because I want to have power for my ideas because they are important and so on, and to see that that's very important.
Absolutely. Well, Birgitta, thank you so much for joining me this morning, and happy Women's Day.
Happy Women's Day.
Keep up all the great work you're doing. It's been such a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you for listening to the Democracy Ideas podcast. Keep following International Idea on social media. We need all of you to participate in constructing better societies. Goodbye.